Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, I ask you to smell the defendant.
Sure, like lawyers work in big skyscrapers and have secretaries. And look at him, he's wearing a belt. That's Hollywood for you.
Please answer the question. Does the defense's case hold water?
No. The defense is wrong.
Objection. Overruled. No. No, I strenuously object.
Oh, well,
strenuously object, then I should take some time to reconsider.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode number 10. It's just milestone after milestone. Really, we're going to celebrate everything. Every episode I make a cake and I say, this is a new milestone. How's it going, Andrew?
I have literally popped the champagne. That's not a joke. I made fish for dinner. So we had champagne. We had champagne with the fish, and I'm finishing up my glass right here. So, but have done so in celebration of episode number 10.
They never thought we would get there. We have to invent a fake they to like say they never believed in us. All right, let's get to our first segment.
Thank you, Dr. Hibbert. I rest my case.
You rest your case?
What? Oh, no, I thought that was just a figure of speech. Case closed.
So, listeners should know by now, this is a closed argument. Interesting segment, unique segment. Our closed argument for today, law professor to students, stop calling me by my first name.
Yeah, this is a Wall Street Journal article about Professor Seema Bharadwajan Bachman, who introduces herself to her students as Professor Bachman, but has discovered each year that her students have started calling her Seema. And I understand that this is a trend in society. My son attended an open school for a while up until this year and called his teachers by their first name, and it was a very sort of collegial environment. And I've got nothing wrong with that, but I'm 100% behind the professor here. If you're a law student, call your professor by Professor Bachman. And the reason it's set forth in there, the law has, for good or for ill, some arcane elements to it. I have friends, I have a close friend of mine from law school who is now a sitting judge in Baltimore. And I call her, I mean, even in social gatherings, if anyone is around, she is judge, right? Mm. She is not Stephanie. She is not, you know, it's just, that's the way that you refer to, there is a majesty, a circumstance. Some of it may be arcane and some of it may be unnecessary, but I think you're badly served coming out of law school if you don't have that sort of hierarchy built in, because you're going to find yourself in court, you know, disrespecting a judge unintentionally.
Ooh, and then do they get to hold you in contempt?
They do not get to hold you in contempt, but what they do get to do is not rule in your favor on certain close motions. So,
which sounds more serious. I would rather be held in contempt.
It's much worse, yeah.
Someday we're going to have a listener by the name of Thomas question of what the hell is being held in contempt, but we'll put in a topic for another show.
Yep.
And also, square. I would like to add, irrespective of everything you just said, if your professor asks you to call him or her by a certain name of any kind, how about you go with that? Like, that doesn't seem hard to just follow. But it's really interesting that you call your friend judge. That's very interesting to me. Am I committing a faux pas by calling you Andrew? Do I need to be calling you something different, or is that
only when I am appointed to the bench, which I was trying to come up with some equally zero probability event, but there are not many podcasting judges these days. So
yeah.
My likelihood of getting an appointment and getting confirmed by the Senate, I think, is pretty low.
Okay.
Dream job though. Dream job. Supreme Court.
So what you're saying, if they're hiring, if anyone knows of anyone hiring a Supreme Court justice, you know.
Yeah, is not that... a lot of openings.
Yeah.
you get back the we really liked your resume.
Yeah, I was going to say, unfortunately, yeah. It's all about networking. You know, it's all about who you know. So yeah,
sadly.
Maybe you get on LinkedIn and say, like, looking for Supreme Court justice job position.
That is my goal and my resume.
Well, when that happens, I will call you Judge. What? Judge Torres? Judge?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. That's what I'll call you. Okay. Let's get over to our main topic for today. We are in part two of X, again, part two of X, of Roe v. Wade. And we were promised by Judge Andrew Torres, we were promised by the Honorable Judge Torres over here, that we were going to hear about a little bit more of the backstory, maybe get into the privacy portion of the argument in today's episode. So I'm really excited for that. Why don't you take it away?
Sure. Remember that the operative argument that we were dealing with is the argument that says a fetus is a person for the purposes of the Constitution, and there's no right to privacy in the Constitution anyway. And we dismissed the first half of that argument mm-hmm. in episode 9. So in this, I think it does make sense to kind of talk about the history of Roe v. Wade, because the privacy question is really inextricably linked with how the court ruled in that case. So what happened in Roe v. Wade? As of 1970, there were absolute bans on abortion in most states.
Oh, okay? Wow.
But most of those bans were fairly recent in terms of when they had been enacted in the past 20 or 30 years. That was not the case, however, with the actual statute that was being questioned. So women's rights groups at the time were looking for a test case to bring to challenge the constitutionality of those laws. And if you will recall from our discussion from the Satanic Temple case in episodes 7 and 8, you cannot just bring a lawsuit with the Supreme Court to say, hey, we think bans on abortion are unconstitutional.
Mm, you need standing, right?
Exactly. You have to find a person who has been aggrieved by one of those laws who has standing to challenge them. And so they found the plaintiff, and her name has since been disclosed, but I'm going to stick with the legal requirements and call her Jane Roe. And she was...
I had no idea that's why that was. So that's not a real name. Roe is fake. Didn't even know right. that.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, because, I mean, she was, you know, breaking the law at the time.
Oh. Yeah. So why is it Wade and not like state of whatever, or, you know, like what? So we're going to find out who sued whom, I guess.
Yeah, you will. The assistant attorney general of the state of Texas was named Wade. He was named Henry Wade. And depending on how you caption the lawsuit is, you know, how it then gets shortened. And so he was sued in a personal capacity, and also the state of Texas was sued. So Jane Roe was living in Texas. She was approached and cooperated with, I believe, Planned Parenthood and with other pro-women's rights groups in 1970. She was pregnant and unmarried, which is important for the history of abortion, because many states had differing laws at the time based on whether you were married and pregnant, at which point, you know, your husband had a vote, and versus unmarried, in which it was often just blanketly prohibited, which was the case in Texas.
That in itself seems questionable constitution-wise.
So Texas had a law first passed in 1854 that makes it a crime, right? Doesn't just, you know, outlaw the practice from the physician or whatever. I mean, you may recall Donald Trump getting into some trouble over this. But historically, abortion was a crime. So it was a crime to, quote, procure an abortion or to attempt one. So a crime for both the woman and the doctor, except with respect to an abortion procured or attempted by medical advice for the purpose of saving the life of the mother. And that was passed by the Texas legislature in 1854, recodified in 1898, and had remained the same for 116 years, and then was challenged by the plaintiff, Jane Roe. And what she sought was a declaratory judgment that law was unconstitutional, and then an injunction prohibiting the state from enforcing that law. And we talked about injunctive relief with the Satanic Temple case. An injunction is basically when you get, let me take a step back. Most lawsuits are over money, right? And even if there is a right that has been violated, the remedy at law for the violation of the of your right is typically monetary damages, right? So I hire you to paint my house. You never paint my house. I sue you. If I can ask for an injunction, which would be requiring you to come out and paint my house. But typically, for reasons that are not worth delving into here, I'm not going to get an injunction to force you to paint my house. What I am going to get is I'm going to get damages, which is either the money I paid you to paint my house or the money necessary to get somebody else to paint my house. And so that is how the law typically handles the majority of suits between private parties. This is what I do on a daily basis. However, when you are aggrieved by a law, you may also seek declaratory relief. And that is, oddly enough, exactly what it sounds like. I mean that without humor, right? Sometimes. Yeah.
The state has to say, I do declare you have been relieved. Yeah.
Yeah. It means that you are seeking the court to make a declaration that that law is unconstitutional or otherwise unenforceable.
Right.
And declaratory relief then has no damages component to it. So you're not saying, and the plaintiff in this case was pregnant. Obviously, this case was brought in 1970, and the Supreme Court didn't rule on it until 1973. So,
you know, linking back to our Satanic Temple episodes.
Right. So there are no damages. She was not prohibited from getting an abortion. She went to another state, but she was still seeking the declaratory relief.
Well, she could
relief.
Have sought gas money, right?
Yeah, you actually could.
Yeah.
That is, you know, in actual damages being recompensed for expenses you earned in anticipation of
a certain amount of mileage on her vehicle, wear and tear.
So that's how the lawsuit came about. And the lawsuit was also joined by a physician who had been arrested under the statute, the Texas abortion law. And there were two lawsuits pending against him. So
is that why the suit goes against the assistant attorney general? Because he's the one who would have to say, I do declare why is it specifically against him?
Because in this case, the assistant attorney general was the person who responded with the interpretation of the state's law. So if we go back to the Satanic Temple, right, that the official who is acting in a state capacity may also be acting in an individual capacity. And so there were allegations that he was acting both individually and also
that's bizarre.
In his official
capacity. Because I would have been like, dude, this is just my job. Don't sue me. Just sue Texas. I'm just doing my job.
But you have to say, right, like when you're asked, if I get an abortion, are you going to arrest me? Right. You as the attorney general are going to say, well, yeah, you know, the law says I'm going to arrest you. So, yes. So that's how that comes about. As opposed to, and this is actually something I think we've gotten a listener question about it. But when you see those wacky websites that say, you know, it's illegal to spit on a horse in, you know, the county of, county.
All those weird laws that are still on the books.
Right. And the real answer with most of those weird laws that are still on the books is nobody's trying to enforce them. So there are no lawsuits to remove them from the books.
Yeah.
Right. So a good example of that in my state of Maryland, you may or may not know, in the former congressional district in which I left, there is an atheist candidate named Jamie Raskin who looks like he's going to win his election to the U.S. House of Representatives. He's running for Chris Van Hollen's seat. Chris Van Hollen is running for the Senate. Raskin is an atheist. The Maryland Constitution prohibits holding office in the state of Maryland. Whether that would include the House of Representatives, I don't know. So, but let's pretend for a minute that it included the House of Representatives. Or let's pretend Jamie Raskin someday runs for governor, right? The law technically on the books says you can't be an atheist and run for office, but nobody is going to enforce that if Raskin wins. So there will be no lawsuit to challenge that provision, and therefore the law will stay on the books, even though we all know that that law is unenforceable.
You know, that's
written.
Interesting. And I'm so sorry for slowing it down, but I just get so curious about this stuff. What if, would it go the other way where the assistant to the assistant to the, no, whoever it is, the attorney general, assistant to the attorney general says, no, I'm not going to enforce that. Do people ever sue and be like, hey dude, why aren't you enforcing this law? Like, does that happen? Where, how does that lawsuit work?
Yeah, absolutely. And typically the way in which that would happen is you would bring an equal protection challenge, right? Like if they're enforcing it against no one, it would be difficult to bring a lawsuit for the reasons I've just described.
Weird. But what if someone just decides like, nah, I'm not enforcing murder? Like, wouldn't there be hypothetically a legal remedy for that?
Sure, because the first time they decide not to do it,
that's unequal protection.
Yeah, you would absolutely, you'd be like, the dude last week got prosecuted for murder. Mm. But yeah, if they just stopped enforcing murder for 30 years and no one noticed, you might have a challenge. I mean, I'm thinking about that. I don't know. I mean, my initial reaction is, you know, you'd always be able to go to an equal protection violation.
Sorry to split hairs, but happens sometimes where they decide to stop enforcing, not murder, obviously, but something, for example, like this law, where they decide to stop enforcing some minor thing. I mean, at the minute they stop enforcing it, there's equal protection problems, right? Just no matter what, because at one point they did and then they don't.
Yeah, there is the potential for an equal protection. Okay. I mean, that's the reason I stopped, because it's not always a violation, but there's always, you would always want to evaluate that to see if it's being applied equally or not.
Right. Okay. Interesting stuff.
Okay. So back to Roe v. Wade. So that's the status of the lawsuit. All these lawsuits were consolidated and brought before a district court. And the district court ruled in favor of the plaintiffs. It said that that the plaintiff and she brought on behalf of herself and all couples. There was another John and Mary Doe, which was a married couple, was also joined into the lawsuit. That's not particularly important for this, but they in preparing this test lawsuit, you know, the groups that were organizing it really covered their bases. So they had unmarried woman, lead plaintiff, doctor, and then a married couple as well, because there was uncertainty about the Supreme Court was going to consider this as a question of first impression. And so it's good legal strategy to say, hey, look, we feel like as of 1970, as a lawyer, you would look at it and say, we feel like the Supreme Court has, you know, is moving in a direction that is protecting individual freedom. This, we think we have a good chance on this. There are several recent decisions that I'm actually going to talk about that would give you confidence. But, you know, you never know when you're asking the Supreme Court to consider something they've never ruled on before, you know, what those judges are going to seize on as being salient. So
you just want to have as many angles of it, like as many plaintiffs or whatever, where there's different, you know.
You want as many avenues to get the relief that you want as possible.
That makes sense.
And that's something I see again, you know, in my much more mundane practice every day. You know, I had a breach of contract case, and I thought, you know, there were two really, really strong grounds for justifying my client's breach of the contract for non-performance. But I made six arguments, and the one the court liked was argument number six. Huh. And I didn't think it was that great.
That makes sense. I get it.
Yeah. So you want to make sure you cover the landscape. So that's what they've done here. And they've also filed suit on, and both Roe, the lead unmarried plaintiff, and the couple filed suit on behalf of herself and all other women, or on behalf of themselves and all other couples that are similarly situated. And the district court, right? This is a federal district court, declared the abortion statutes void and said, yep, we agree. That court said, we think that the Ninth Amendment to the Constitution, that's the one of the catch-all provisions at the end of the Bill of Rights that says the rights that are not specifically enumerated are reserved to the states and to the people. And the district court said, the fundamental right of single women and married persons to choose whether to have children is protected by the Ninth Amendment. And then it doesn't say this, but again, atheistically speaking, listeners will know this, and you will know this, and then incorporated to the states through the 14th Amendment.
Yeah.
Right? So the district court said, we agree with you. And then the state of Texas, through Wade, appealed to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, United States Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit, which sits over Texas and some other states. And then the Supreme Court reached down, ordered that appeal in abeyance and said, look, this case is coming to the Supreme Court eventually. There's no sense having, you know, waiting for the Fifth Circuit to issue an appeal here. We're going to take it and rule on the case. And so the Supreme Court took it up. And so that's the procedural posture that the case came about. And then the Supreme Court went through a bunch of preliminary questions, including addressing the question on standing that we talked about in the Satanic Temple
case. Right. Yeah. I already know how that ends.
Yeah. And in the standing case, although they said Roe, obviously, she was pregnant. This is therefore, you know, not a moot case. There's a live case or controversy, and this is capable of repetition yet evading review, which was the language we talked about in that case. It held that the doctor did not have standing. And I could go through that. It's not particularly important, but they said his rights are going to be fully protected when we examine the validity of the statute as applies to the woman. So there's no need for him to be a part of this case, so he can get out.
Okay, but does that imply that a punishment to the doctor wouldn't have been constitutional, or does that not matter?
No, it doesn't imply that at all. When you intervene in a case, it is because you think that there is a right that is implicated by the case is not being adequately protected by the existing parties. And what the Supreme Court was saying was, no, if examining the constitutionality of the statute, that statute will rise or fall based on how we determine how it affects the woman.
Right. Okay, I see what you're saying.
We can't come up with a scenario under which we would say it's perfectly okay to punish the woman, but we're not going to punish the doctor.
Right. Gotcha.
And that's when you would allow. And I have had, you know, again, in sort of mundane civil cases, I have represented intervenors. So let me give you a good example. This is where I successfully intervened in a case. There was a challenge. I represent a company that had a government contract, right, to provide, was competing to provide extra supplemental educational services, tutoring to students. And there was a challenge on the award of the contract so the contract was awarded to Party C. There was a challenge to that by Party B, which was another bidder who bidded on the contract but didn't get it. And we successfully intervened because we were next in line. Party B was not. And our argument was, Party B is not going to advocate on behalf of our interest because we think if you throw out the contract, if you throw out the award to Party C, you should give it to my client instead because they're next in line. And Party B is only in there to argue for the contract going to themselves.
Mm.
And we were allowed to intervene because we were going to make arguments that Party B was not going to make. And that's really the test is there an interest? Is there a potential interpretation of the law that the existing parties are not going to develop? You know, in that case, there was, right? Because neither one of them was going to argue, if you throw this out, we give it to the next person in line, because neither one of them wanted, neither the government agency nor the other protester wanted that result. So we were allowed to intervene. That makes sense?
Yeah.
But here, the ruling was, yeah, doctors' interests are adequately protected by the women plaintiffs, that there was no unique argument that the doctors were going to make that was not already reflected. And I should expand. I've said unique argument, but it really is a test of the specific interests that are implicated, you can make a different argument that nevertheless aligns with the posture of the parties. And the way in which you do that in a Supreme Court case is not by intervening, but is by filing what they call an amicus brief. And I don't know if you've seen that in news reports on Supreme Court cases before.
Right. I know the term.
Yeah. Amicus, if you remember Latin, I'm going back to my fantastic high school Latin here, but it means friend of the court. And basically, you can file an amicus brief on behalf of one side of the case with the consent of the parties that are to the case that raises a different argument that is nevertheless aligned with the interests of one of the two parties. So it's less intrusive than letting, because if you let the party intervene, they're now a party to the case, right? Like that is the court saying, we think you have interests that will be adjudicated by this case. Whereas if you're just an amicus filing, what you're saying is, we care how this case comes out and we want to make this argument. And the Supreme Court, I will not say that amicus briefs are of no value, but it is a very small number of cases in which the amicus briefs make a difference.
Oh, okay.
But particularly in cases that have, you know, massive public political components, you will see amicus briefs filed by parties that would not be allowed to intervene. But
they want to have their arguments considered.
They want to have their own arguments considered. And the court can do whatever they want with them.
All right.
The court's not required to read an amicus brief. They're not required to do anything about it. No party gets to file a response. Occasionally, parties will incorporate some of amicus briefs by reference in their main briefs.
It's weird that I know the term because it sounds so obscure. It sounds like it never matters.
it is used frequently in public organizations, including some that I'm sure you support and agree with, as a way of rallying the troops, right? So if you support the ACLU or Americans United or something like that, and there is a church separation case in which they're not the lawyers, they don't represent anybody, and they're not a party, they may nevertheless say, oh, hey, we're filing an amicus brief in this case in order to make sure that our position is well represented before the court. Yeah, so that's probably where you've seen it.
Okay.
So we go through standing. Court says the pregnant woman, Jane Roe, has standing to bring this case, even though she's no longer pregnant because of the capable of repetition yet evading review doctrine. The doctors have to get out. The married couple has to get out because the woman was not pregnant at the time of the filing of the lawsuit. And so that was considered speculative and not an actual case or controversy.
Okay.
So we're left with just Roe versus Wade. And then the court says, okay, what's the argument here? And the argument is that the Texas laws and other similar laws improperly invade the right to choose whether to terminate your pregnancy, and that that right is inherent in the Constitution and is found either in the Ninth Amendment, which was what the district court said, right, as one of the rights reserved to the people, or in the concept of ordered personal liberty that is embodied in the 14th Amendment Due Process Clause, which is then protected by the, quote, penumbra, which is a fancy Latin word meaning shadow.
Yeah, I like that word.
Of the various Bill of Rights, so First, Fourth, Ninth Amendment, 14th Amendment, that they sort of cast a shadow from which we divine the right to privacy. And that phrasing, the penumbra phrasing, is what I think has gotten a lot of right-wing judicial activists sort of up in arms about, like, see, they're just making stuff
right,
up.
Like it's not specific enough.
Yeah, you know, penumbras aren't in the Constitution. and so, you know, what I would say with respect to that is I would focus on two specific things that are in Supreme Court precedent that use the same reasoning.
Well, I was totally going to ask you, does the penumbra term come up other places? That was going to be my first question.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Before this, so, independent of this case?
Yes.
Okay.
And so here's what the Supreme Court says, and I'm going to omit the citations. If you're reading along with us in Roe v. Wade, this is section 8. It begins on page 152. So here's what the majority says in Roe v. Wade. And I want you to think about how this is characterized today. The Constitution does not explicitly mention any right to privacy. In a line of decisions, however, going back perhaps as far as Union Pacific Railroad versus Botsford, which is 1891, the court has recognized that a right of personal privacy or guarantee of certain areas of zones of privacy does exist under the Constitution. In varying contexts, the court or individual justices have found at least the roots of that right in the First Amendment, in the Fourth and Fifth Amendments, in the penumbras of the Bill of Rights, in the Ninth Amendment, or in the concept of liberty guaranteed by the first section of the 14th Amendment. And all of those, every time I paused, there was a case.
No.
and I'm not, just out of respect for our audience, I'm not going to read these case citations, but they include an 1886 case, a 1928 case, a 1923 case. So again, this is not something just made up on the spot in 1973 by a liberal court.
Would Scalia say, but yeah, but those cases aren't the Constitution. I get
Correct.
To disregard all those. Yeah.
Yeah. It did the founding fathers in 1789 think no. So, you know, take your 1886 case and go home. But most lawyers would say, well, you know, look, if this concept of, you know, ordered liberty has been around for 100 years, we at least have to take it seriously. But again, notice that, you know, the sort of implicit straw man that's set up the Supreme Court, very, very clear. Yes, we recognize the word privacy is not in the Constitution. Nevertheless, we've used that term when talking about what amendments mean, and specifically what the First Amendment means, what the Fourth Amendment, what the Fifth, what the Ninth, what the 14th Amendments mean. Then the Supreme Court says, these decisions make it clear that only personal rights that can be deemed, quote, fundamental or, quote, implicit in the concept of ordered liberty are included in this guarantee of personal privacy. They also make it clear that this right has some extension to activities relating to marriage, procreation, contraception, family relationships, and child rearing and education. And I want to focus on two of those cases that are that I have not read, but that are discussed in this long paragraph. Okay. And the first is Loving versus Virginia, which is a 1967
Supreme Court case. I've heard of that. Oh, yeah, that's right. Isn't there a movie coming out about that?
There might be. I don't know. I don't know anything about
contemporary.
That's right.
Never mind. I'm asking the wrong person. I could be way off, but is that the interracial marriage case?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes,
okay. There's a movie coming out about it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll see it in 25 years.
yeah. They will have been reversed by then. There will be no. Right. Yeah.
So, yes, Loving versus Virginia, 1967 case that struck down Virginia's laws against miscegenation or interracial marriage. And Griswold versus Connecticut, which is a 1967 case. The site here is a super site, so I don't have the date, but I think it's 1967, could be 1968. That case struck down a law that prohibited selling contraceptive device, 1965 case, I just scrolled back for it, but prohibited selling contraceptives to unmarried individuals.
Oh.
So the first question that I would ask anybody who says the right to privacy is not in the Constitution is, so are you telling me that the Supreme Court was wrong in Griswold and in Loving versus Virginia? Which is to say, it's perfectly okay with you if the state of Alabama wants to ban interracial marriage. You think the Constitution says nothing about that. Is that correct? And then similarly, if the state of Mississippi wants to make it illegal for unmarried women to purchase contraceptives, you're okay with that. And if you are, at least you're consistent.
Well, here's the weird thing, though, because I wouldn't have thought of either of those as relating to a right to privacy. I would have thought they were both equal protection.
Interesting. Make your equal protection argument.
Well, I would think that similarly to the eHarmony and that kind of thing, where, okay, sure, a white person can marry a white person, but a black person can't marry a black. You know, that seems pretty obvious to me. That's you have a different law for different races. You know, that seems like an equal protection. And then,
but keep in mind there, the reason that you have a law is because you have a law that protects equal protection in places of public accommodation, right? So the problem with the issuing of a marriage certificate is that doesn't trigger within those specific state equal protection cases that protect places of, you know, the businesses that that do business with
public. I guess I missed that. So that equal protection thing is actually specific to public places of business or whatever?
Correct.
Oh, man. How did I not know that? Okay. Now, so now I see what you mean. Well, yes. but wouldn't that affect the contraceptive one?
It could be an argument in the contraceptive one. And then the question would be whether there was a justification. You would have to have a compelling state interest that justified the distinction between married and unmarried couples.
Right.
But remember that, I mean, the point of all this, and I think that's very creative. The point of going through the discussion is, in order to overturn a state law, you have to find that right either in a federal law that supersedes the state law, right, that is meant to preempt the state law, or in the Constitution itself.
Right.
And if there isn't, then, you know, you're sort of left with, well, this seems bad, but I don't know, who are we to tell Mississippi that, you know, they can't prohibit the sale of constitution of contraceptives to those, you know, unmarried harlots, right?
Yeah.
So that's kind of the first step when, in my view, when someone says there's no right to privacy in the Constitution, is to say, well, you know, the Supreme Court analyzed that the same way, right? We know the word isn't in the Constitution, just like the words separation of church and state aren't in the Constitution, just like lots of contemporary phrases that we use to describe our rights are not in the Constitution, but are instead in case law. But there's a pretty long-standing body of case law finding that the principle of liberty, and certainly on these personal crucial decisions, is indeed protected by the Constitution, and that's consistent with what the Bill of Rights was meant to do, right? Like the Bill of Rights was sort of meant to protect this kind of Lockean system that if you are not hurting somebody and the government, that the government has to show a compelling interest before it intervenes in the most private decisions that you make, in telling you who you can't marry or how you have to have children or that sort of thing. And that, right, I think, is a pretty conservative case, to be honest with you.
So that's why it's privacy, because I don't need the government looking into whether I'm married or not.
Exactly.
Okay.
And privacy, that I wish they'd picked a better word than privacy.
Okay, yeah, yeah. Maybe right? it's different from my
Yeah, it is, you know, in the privacy of your own head and your own marital relationship, do you want to have a child? Do you want to terminate that pregnancy? They could have picked a better word. They do call it ordered liberty. They could have picked a better word than privacy, and they certainly could have picked a better word than penumbra, which is just, you know, I mean, that is like
I love that
John
word.
Kerry windsurfing. Like, but doesn't it carry that, like, you know, character of, you know, sort of effete liberal intellectual snobs, like talking about their penumbras while sipping their lattes?
And, yeah.
You know,
we don't have enough. The problem is we don't have enough eclipses for people to be more familiar with the penumbra, the umbra. Are there any umbras of the law? Is
that there? There are no umbras.
Just penumbras. Okay.
So why don't we pull the discussion to a close on that?
We got to, because we now have what we might as well edit and change to a 45-minute limit in our Patreon, because you guys are just so nice. We want to give you that time. But before we do, let's go to not an official segment, but our last thing we want to talk about today, which is we made a number of guest appearances, and we just like to give those shows a little publicity for being kind enough to have us on to talk about this show and for Andrew to talk about some interesting legal issues. I'll start. I went on Angry Black Rant the other week. I'm not totally sure on the release. We're recording this ahead of time, but I believe it will have already been out. So I'd just like to say thanks so much to Ishmael for having me on Angry Black Rant. We talked about a lot of issues, not exactly relating to the show, but we also talked a good amount about opening arguments. And I want to thank Ishmael for that. And I highly recommend his show, Angry Black Rant.
Yeah, love Ishmael.
Definitely.
I was on episode 80 of the Gay Theist Manifesto. I'll have a link in the show notes. Callie and Ari are fantastic. Thomas has been on the show before, talking about the horrors of President Trump. And it's a great show. We went over a little bit of old territory, but hit some new territory and some interesting conversations on public accommodation and in equal access under law, on the Christian Mingle settlement, on the concept of promoting change through the judiciary versus having it arrive organically. It was a good episode, and we love Callie and Ari, and check that out.
Definitely. Also, we were on Cognitive Dissonance, and that, I mean, what can I say about those guys? Longtime friends. I love CogDis so much. I got to see him the other month. I got to go to Chicago and actually record in Glory Hole Studios. Wasn't able to do that this time, but nonetheless, it was still a fun time was had by all. And I really, really appreciate everything those guys have done in promoting my work throughout the years. And specifically in this case, what is an amazing show and opening argument. So thanks so much to Tom and Cecil. Check out Cognitive Dissonance if you haven't already.
Yep. And finally, I went on Scathing Atheist. That's also being recorded as we're recording this, but I believe it's going to be episode number 185. And as with CogDis, Thomas and I have been huge fans of Scathing and God Awful Movies, yeah, since time immemorial. And those guys, Noah, Heath, and Eli, have been tremendous supporters of us. They have done a lot to help us out in launching the show and to promote the show. They are friends of the show in every sense of the word. And I can't imagine we have any listeners who are not also yeah. listening to Scathing. Well, no, some members of my family. So, so Aunt Donna, so I want you to go. I want you to go listen to. You may or may not enjoy this. So to think about it. No, but it's a great show. And God Awful Movies, I think you and I agree is the funniest thing on the face of the planet.
It is very fun. I love that show so much.
So we want to give a sincere thanks to our new patrons. They are Drew Daly, Adrian Porter, Mick H., Gene Law, Nate Canast, Alan Crawford, Patrick, Sean Zipperer, Zachary Cribbins, Kevin Lehman, Gregory Brown, Pete Wilco, Gerald Lott, Pretheist, Lizzie in the Lab, Kaylee Bell, Caleb Bell, Matt Carl, Carl Otterson, Brusque Platypus, David C. Bruce, Christopher Arguin, Deron Gardner, David Chidester, Peter Brown, Jer, Aaron, Anderson Jones, Patrick Dobbins, Chris Eli, Joshua Moldenhauer, Ricky Burnett, George Green, Jeffrey Serco, Joseph Reynolds, and Jeff Hopper. Thank you guys so much for supporting the show on Patreon.
Absolutely. And now we need to thank our all-time greats, our Hall of Famers, the Inciting Incident Podcast, Jeff S., Kaylee Reiser, Michael, Hunter Ash, Patrick Fussell. Thank you for the pronunciation correction there. Amanda Lipnack, Desecrator, Roger Metcalf, Jim Grove, Steve Sigmund, Anonymous, Dale, Dave Nichols of Positively Doubtful Podcast, and Eli Bosnick and Dan Irizarry. Thank you guys so much for being our top patrons. So we got to get out of here. It's been another very fascinating episode. As always, thanks, Andrew, for being an expert. I'll thank myself for not being an expert.
As always, thanks to Thomas for driving the show and making it happen and asking the best questions.
The show, do I get to say, I'll turn this thing around. I'll turn this show right around, Andrew.
That is our next segment. We're going to launch. I will turn this car around.
All right. Thanks for listening. Go to patreon.com/law if you'd like to extend our showtime. Thanks, and we'll see you next week.
Stop breaking the law, asshole!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.